So once again, sitting, knowing that you're sitting, aware of the body, touching the chair, touching the cushion, touching the floor, aware of the hands touching the legs. A few minutes of just sitting and enjoying. Just sitting, enjoying, just breathing. And we'll begin to experiment with a way of asking a meditative question. Just to read a little bit to you first. Meditative questions cannot be answered solely by the intellect. The asking of a meditative question in and of itself awakens an innate wisdom. We ask the question and then let go of any mental answers that arise. To practice with such questions is to relinquish the desire for results, because the desire for an answer obscures true insight. The practice of asking meditative questions is like throwing a stone in a pond. After throwing the stone, we observe and we listen. We don't throw stone after stone. Every now and then, we ask a question. And then we listen with great attentiveness and care. We don't focus on questions that bring restlessness and doubt. We also don't ask too many meditative questions. Just one can do for several months at a time. Sometimes we stumble inadvertently upon a great question, finding one that captivates our attention and wakes us up. When that happens, use that one question until it wears itself out. The point of all this is to foster an attitude of openness and curiosity. Each of us has different questions that matter to us. If you discover a good question, keep it alive and ask it under all circumstances. The key is to ask it in all situations, not just some. A meditative question needs to be applied to all conditions if we are to see into things differently than we previously have. One question I asked for more than a year was this: can another moment be better than the moment I am in now? I asked it when experiences were fine, and I asked it in the midst of pain. I asked this question whenever I thought to ask it, as a practice throughout the day. When I began to ask, I knew the answer, but only intellectually, not through my lived experience. From an intellectual point of view, it's easy to know that there cannot be any better moment than the one we are in, because this is the only moment there is. But to know this and live it are quite different than believing it in theory. An authentic meditative question is always fresh and distinct from a conditioned thought. It has the potential to take us to silence, ease, peace, and spaciousness. The difference between wise reflection and conditioned thinking is that in thinking there is clinging and suffering. In reflection there is curiosity and exploration. Ask what you are genuinely interested in, not what you think you should be interested in. An inner sense grows as to which questions bring true peace and lead to more peace, and which bring ever greater confusion. Meditative questions are ways to guide our lives and discover inner liberation. In asking a meditative question, we develop a natural inclination toward investigation. As this growing interest in inquiry occurs, We use whatever questions naturally arise. Questioning in this way is liberating. The question itself is a bridge from the conditioned to the unconditioned, and thus from confusion to inner freedom. So sitting with open, hearted attention, breath in the background, body in the background, sound in the background. Fresh attention to whatever is arising, emerging, appearing right here and right now. Resting easily within this body, within this moment. Don't hold on tightly to any particular anchor, such as the breath or such as a sound. Sitting without ideas or concepts or expectations, agendas. Just sitting. And every so often, throwing a question in, the way we might throw a stone into a pond. Throw it in. Let it reverberate. Let it affect the water around the stone. Listen. Don't answer the question out of what you think you already know. Listen to this moment, life as it is responding to you right here and right now. What should you be asking? Perhaps this question that I mentioned when I was reading, is there any better moment than this moment right now? It's a good question. Another question might be, is there love for this too? Whatever is happening, I like this, I don't like that, is there love for this too? What is the mind aware of right now? If I'm not happy in this moment, why not? Now, none of these do you want to go about in any kind of analytical way. In a certain way, they're all absurd questions. And yet, asking a question such as this, a meditative question, and listening with our whole body, our whole hearts, can change a life. So, sitting, present, still, silent, every so often throw a question in. And then listen. May all beings have peacefulness of mind. May all beings have compassion of heart. May all beings be embraced by kindness. Okay. So, coming to the end of the retreat, I wonder if it's possible to have a little bit more light, but not these lights. So I can see everybody in the back there. Are there any more lights? Or yeah, that's good. I mean, maybe not that one. Yeah, that one, but not that one. Yeah. I mean, that's better. I guess I was thinking. So nothing back there. Like, that's not a light right up there. Okay. All right. So I want to thank you for hanging in there. These retreats in the middle of our everyday life are interesting because when you go on a longer retreat, you know, those of you who have been on longer retreats, you're used to kind of moving through in the first couple of days a lot of restlessness or sleepiness or resistance, all this stuff. And then usually, you know, it smooths out at least a little bit as the retreat goes on. And then you pop out, usually in good shape, which makes you want to do another retreat. If you didn't pop out in good shape, you would, you know, you would not be back. And I'm sure that does happen to those who I don't see again. But generally that's the way a retreat goes. But a retreat like this, in the middle of your domestic life, in the middle of your daily life, in the middle of your life as it is, it can be more challenging because you've got to meet more energies a little bit more vividly than you might as a retreat goes on. So I appreciate it. I appreciate the diligence and the interest and the sincerity and most of all just hanging in there. We've moved through a lot of material through these last 2 days, beginning by looking at this squeeze in life that, you know, you don't always feel to be constant. It depends on how awake you are, I would say, in terms of whether you feel it to be constant or not, because it's easy when things are going well or, you know, conditions are delightful to really not recognize it, to not see that it's there. And then when things are really hard, when we're in the midst of great loss or transition or change, you know, it can, as I said earlier, it can feel like a vice and not a squeeze. You just feel like you're just being squeezed to nothing. And those are really, really difficult times as well as possibly fertile times if we have a practice. These are the things that just beat us down if we don't have a practice. But if we have a practice, we can look, we can bring some degree of interest to our life. We can expand. We can look at these 5 recollections that we took on yesterday. And we can make space around them and recognize their naturalness and recognize their universality. recognizing the body belongs to nature, the mind belongs to nature, and nobody's exempt, nobody's left out. So by rubbing up against the realities of old age, sickness, death, and loss, we come to a different understanding in our life. But we have to acknowledge and recognize and not ignore and not, you know, I don't know, fiddle why Rome burns or something like that. I remember being on a long retreat really early on, and I was just having a hard time. I was coming up against a lot, and I got a postcard from my father, and he said, "Your mother and I are having so much fun." It was really hard for him to understand being on retreat and not being able to read and not listening to beautiful music and not, you know, being able to talk, and all these things were really impossible to understand. And just, you know, when I got that postcard, "Your mother and I are having lots of fun," you know, I knew them. And, you know, I knew that it couldn't be completely fun. Just living with them, you know, human, and all of the normal human angst and tensions and all of that, you know. But just that trying, that effort to have fun in the midst of the realities of life. And in a meditative way, there's nothing wrong with fun, right? And in a meditative way, it's what I was speaking about this morning. It's this joy that can arise and a kind of a meditative pleasure that, you know, as we practice, we can experience whatever it is that we're doing when we are, you know, quote, having fun. It's different because we're not as attached to the activity, you know? We're not grasping onto the this or the that, the object or the person, you know? We're enjoying ourselves, and we can enjoy conditions, but conditions are enjoyable. But we're not adding that component of trying to hold on to that which cannot be held on to. I mean, this is what we need to imprint upon our hearts, is that it's not our fault, it's not a problem, it's not a fault in the universe. It just, nothing can be held on to. You know, what the Buddha said, nothing whatsoever can, I think the exact quote is, "Nothing whatsoever should be clung to." But really, you know, nothing whatsoever can be clung to either, right? I don't want to one-up the Buddha, but but nothing can be clung to, and that's where the suffering comes in. So exploring this whole territory and remembering the importance, the essential nature of loving kindness and compassion. Because we can't do this. We just can't do this. We can't turn around and face the pain and face the realities of life and live free and easy and looking at life directly in its eyeball if we don't encourage loving kindness as a training within ourselves. And if we don't grow in compassion for our own pain and compassion for the pain of our dear ones and compassion for the sorrows in this world. You know, it's what naturally happens as we practice. This is all natural and organic. As natural as it is that this body belongs to nature, that this mind belongs to nature, the Dharma is natural and organic. And we understand it through attending, through kindly attending, not harshly attending. We understand it through sitting and through paying attention. And through sustaining our attention at times as well. You know, we understand through our capacity to be awake and aware and curious and interested instead of spaced out and sleepwalking through our lives. The path, of course, Noble Eightfold Path of ethics, meditation and wisdom. But another way of looking at the Eightfold Path, shamatha vipassana, calming our minds and using that calmness to look deeply into the true nature of ourselves and of everything, of all phenomena. You know, so this practice of encouraging calm and steadiness and inner balance and an inner buoyancy, which offers an initial level of peacefulness and satisfaction and not being, as I said earlier, not being quite as hungry, you know? So this calmness and this steadiness, and then using it to look more deeply into life as it is. Yeah. And then this afternoon, sometimes I like to talk about the practices construction and then deconstruction. You know, like you make those toothpick houses or those house of cards and then you collapse it. Or the sand drawings where, you know, practitioners of the sand drawings, impeccable, beautiful, beautiful, and then it's gone. You know, yeah. So construction and deconstruction. One Tibetan Lama once said, get out of the construction business. You know, just get out of the construction business, constructing a sense of self, constructing that which is going to collapse onto itself. So so some of the practice is building up and some of the practice is letting fall apart. And so this afternoon, that's what we were doing. We were looking at how liberation comes about, which is through relaxing the grasping, you know, looking at the clinging and allowing for a greater degree of spaciousness and, you know, studying our attachments instead of just thinking we shouldn't have any or trying to get rid of them or I'm not attached except for this. You know, I think as we continue on this path longer and longer, sometimes we think we should get a break for one attachment, you know, because we've let go of most, we should get to hang on to one. But this is laws of nature. It just doesn't work like that. We don't get to hold on to anything. So more love and less attachment. You know, that's what the practice is encouraging and nourishing a greater capacity to love and letting go, letting be. And that's the suffering aspect, is the grasping. And then looking, you know, I was describing a kind of Dharma medicine for the different ways that we attach, because there's different forms or expressions of attachment. And one form of attachment is wanting something to last. And what we want to last is not always so wonderful, you know, but we just want it to last. And other times it is so wonderful, and we want it to last. We want to be able to capture it or possess it or claim it in some way. And I was suggesting that Dharma medicine, when we want something to continue, when it just can't, it's not its fault, it just can't. Dharma medicine is to not isolate it as being more important than anything else, because that's what we do, you know? That's what we do. We make it more special, and we see it as, you know, when we really get caught, when we really get stuck, and, you know, this is what the movies are all about, we can see that one, whatever it is, just completely captures our attention. And that's when we begin obsessing and, you know, we're captivated by something that is not going to last. So this is tender work, right? I mean, especially if it's a person, it's really tender work. But we want to, again, encourage more love and less attachment. So to recognize the isolating, you know, the making special, and then recognizing that oftentimes when we do this, we're neglecting other things that are really important to us. You know, when we get caught or captivated, we're actually forgetting what has always been important to us, but something else is taking over and capturing our attention. And so to bring in other elements of life is really a helpful medicine. And also, as I was suggesting, asking the question, what else is happening? It's a really simple question to ask. You know, so whatever your mind state is, whatever it might be, what else is happening right now? Yeah, it's very helpful. So it's not this effort to get rid of attachments, because that sense of will is not helpful and doesn't work. And then those times when we are holding on and resisting and really want to get rid of something, the other side, you know, of wanting something to last, wanting to get rid of the resistance and the aversion. Some way, Dharma medicine being some way of allowing and accepting and making space for, and maybe bringing metta in at that point, you know, any kind of love is going to be helpful. And then the third attachment is always identification. You know, we come upon something and this is me, this is who I am, and we're lost in it, we're confused. And to recognize that everything is nature. And sometimes just to remind yourself that everything is nature is something quite helpful. And then we worked a bit with a meditative question. And this is such a wonderful, wonderful aspect of this practice, is to find a meditative question at times when, you know, we did this towards the end of our retreat because it's good if there is some calmness. You know, when I say throwing a stone in a pond, it's helpful if the pond is a pond, not an ocean, you know, with waves. It's a still pond. So if the mind is still, if the mind is quieter, then you throw something in, and it's quite enlightening, actually. You know, what you can understand, not so much through the intellect, which no problem with that. It's helpful to understand through the intellect. You know, have wise view, but something that actually changes your life. You know, something that actually is transformative, that affects everything, that affects the body, that affects how you mail your letters, all of that. Everything affects every moment in your life. And so I was suggesting a few questions that you might ask, but there are many questions. And I actually, in the book, I have a long list of questions that, you know, you don't want to ask the list of questions. You want to look to see, is there one particular question that that really interests you? You know, what's meant by that? And it draws you in, and then you ask, and it can be quite wonderful. So from Lost to Liberation, or from Sun Just Came Out, from the constant squeeze to enoughness, to a sense of wholeness, of losing our hunger, that's a way of putting it, that losing our hunger. And just to read a little bit to you, about enoughness. One classical way the Buddha described coming to terms with loss is through reflecting and taking to heart the five recollections. The five recollections help us to recognize and accept the realities in our lives, the fact that we are subject to old age, sickness, and death, and lose everything dear to us. The paradox is that in embracing these truths, another way of living is illuminated. The path is made visible as we walk it, and we begin to see for ourselves that the cause of dissatisfaction is grasping and attaching to that which is temporary, intrinsically insubstantial, and can provide only limited satisfaction. In seeing the true nature of phenomena, we turn toward Buddha nature, which is an absence of attachment and a fullness of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. In the first chapter, I refer to Ajahn Mahabua's description of suffering as a constant squeeze. I mention it here again to emphasize the fact that the start of the path is the recognition of suffering. We begin to turn toward this ache within the heart with compassionate attentiveness instead of seeking to avoid it. As Ajahn Chah said, there is the suffering that leads to further suffering and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering, to lasting peacefulness. To ignore the constant squeeze leads to greater sorrow. To turn toward the ache in the heart is painful and uncomfortable and leads to its end. Ajahn Mahabua defined the word nirvana as enough. As we dedicate ourselves to the practice, the sense of feeling constantly squeezed by conditions in life begins to ease, and we discover an inner enoughness. As we well know, we can't ever have enough when it comes to the conditions in life. What Ajahn Mahabua is referring to is a dimension of being that is free from a sense of insufficiency. We often fear that something is missing within us, that something is wrong with us. We live with a pervasive sense that we are not enough, and no matter how much we try, we will never be enough. No matter how much we are praised, the praise is not enough. No matter how much we succeed in something important to us, our success is not enough. When we get something, we want more of it. We think, if only I tried harder, I might get what I need. Conditions might give me what I need. But neither inner conditions, thoughts, sights, sounds, tastes, smells, touches, feelings, nor outer circumstances will ever be enough. We keep waiting for something to complete us. It is paradoxically true that something is indeed missing, the wisdom of knowing that nothing is missing. The truth is that we will never be enough if we continue down the path of trying to fill ourselves through getting and accumulating. We will only succeed in reifying the delusion that we are not enough. We live in a culture in which consumption reigns supreme, yet our inner culture can be one of letting go. Letting go is a true refuge. Okay, so the end. But just to see if there's anything on your mind that you want to, we have a few minutes, anything on your mind that you want to ask about or inquire into, anything that is confusing or anything about the day today. Say again.
I really enjoyed working between the different postures and the sacred waiting. It was very,
yeah.
It was wonderful, actually.
Uh-huh.
Once I realized that we were just staying there.
Oh.
I felt so calm.
Yeah.
It was like, wow, maybe I
yes. 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 Yes, it's a great practice. And to stand without thinking, or to stand being aware of this sense of constant movement of, you know, I'm going to do this, I have to do this, I have to go down my list. What's going to happen in the next moment? But just stand, you know, this sense of sacred waiting. Yeah, yeah, you understood that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Go to it. Yeah.
I want to second what she said, but also I try to practice lying down meditation, and it's always difficult for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's one of the talks that Joseph Goldstein talks about is lying down and trying to pay attention to the last breath before you fall asleep.
Oh. That's a Munindra thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 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 Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A few things that you mentioned, just holding your hand up, or you know, just, all that was very helpful.
Okay.
I really appreciate it. Finding a technique that might
right.
work.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole day was wonderful, so thank you so much.
Good.
You also rode the wave of everybody else. So, okay, thank you, everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to fill you in on this practice of the last breath. You're kind of supposed to laugh. You know, I think you probably heard it on a tape.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah, yeah. If there were people there, people would have laughed. You know, real people would have laughed. I mean, it's not that it's not possible, but you really don't want to try to attain that. yeah, every morning waking up like you failed the night before. It's not a good start to the day. Yeah. But to take up a practice when you're lying there before you go to sleep is extraordinarily important. And It's something that you have to kind of just keep trying to remember, because it's easy to forget. Yeah, just because of so many years of not. Yeah, but if you remind yourself and you start doing it, you know, every time you remember, it plants a seed of remembering at another point. So it's always good. You know, so even if you remember once and then you forget for 4 days and then you remember, it's excellent, because that will plant a seed for another moment of remembering at some other point. Yeah. It's really important, because when we're lying down and we're kind of, I'm going to use the word defenseless, when we're kind of defenseless and we're just lying there prone, it's when, even if we practice the best that we've been able to all day, everything just kind of comes. You know, the habitual worry, the highlighted thoughts about what's wrong and what we're supposed to do. We get up in the morning and we can do it. You know, we can do it. Here we are, we can do it. But it gets so highlighted, as because the emotion can be so strong in the middle of the night, and the worry can be so strong. So, and even, you know, the upsetness with different people can be so strong. So any practice you take up, you know, metta, I think, is a great practice when you're lying down before you go to sleep. The Buddha said that metta practice will help your sleep life, in terms of not, if you have nightmares, not having nightmares, or eventually not. And a lot of the benefits of metta practice you really can't prove. Some of them are really funny. This one you can prove, or this one I can tell you I know, because of so many people throughout the years seeing that change for them. It's really great, yeah. So that's actually the one that I most would recommend for going to sleep, because it collects the mind, you know. Sometimes the breath can be a little wispy, and the phrases are a little bit more like you can do them. Yeah, and you don't have to keep doing it. Don't you know, like do the thing of whatever would correlate with the last breath. Don't do that. Just enjoy it. You know, a few rounds, and then off to sleep. Yeah, good. Anybody else? Yeah, Anne. Hi. Can't know. Right. Yeah. Can't know. Yeah. I think it's very good. Yeah, I think it's very good in our culture, because there's such a kind of sense of we're supposed to know. We've missed the last, you know, Facebook posting. We're supposed to know. Or we've missed some crucial news that, you know, give me a break, right? Right, that we're supposed to know, and then we're supposed to be able to talk to others about it, and we're supposed to know everything. And we're not. It's just information. Right. No. Yes, you can know that the result's going to be good. You do need to know that. That's the greater vision, that it's good. But how that you're going to get there, that you can't know. Because I see the practices like this, you know, there's an upward curve, but there's the dips as well. Did that make sense? Yeah, like that, yeah. And the dips are part of the whole thing. And we get so, you know, angst-ridden about the dips, but they're just dips. They're natural. And we can't know what is going to come out of the dips that could be the most important thing that we've ever seen before, that we actually can trust, that we can actually trust. So, yeah, that's good. Yeah. Yeah, Leah? Yeah. Yeah, you heard that. Word is getting out. No. Only to you. For some reason, I don't know how these things happen, but on Amazon with the book, you know, with the written book, there's a space for the drawn book. Just for everybody to know, I drew a book a long time ago of little beings acting, doing everything mindfully. And I was actually tempted to not write a book, but to just write a sequel, you know? Like everything I left out, I would put in the sequel. But anyway, so there's a space for it in Amazon. There's no book there, you know, because you can't order it on Amazon. But these things are super expensive, I guess. So you can't order it on Amazon. But there's a space for the book. So it shows that there actually is a book somewhere in this universe. Right now, it is being printed in India. And it's just taking a while for it to be printed. It's a little bit bigger. You know, as you know, the small book is 3.5 by 2.75. And this is a little bit bigger because the printing press is a little bit bigger. Yeah. So some people say they can't even, like Rodney, he says, I can't even see it. You know? Thank you so much. So this is just a little bit bigger. So not a little bit. It's like that, you know, like 3x4 or something. And the little people. My whole family knows these little beings. We call them the little people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the little people are a little bit bigger. So I don't know. You know, I keep getting messages. It's almost done. It's almost done. But I don't know. Yeah. And you can get it at in Cambridge, CIMC, or at IMS. Those will be. No, but the new one. Yeah. No, but they will be. Eventually, you will be able to order. You'll be able to exactly. You'll be able to get them from IMS. Somebody recently coming up for you know, signing the Magnanimous Heart. She didn't have one because she liked the picture book better. So she brought me a fossil. Like that she had this little book for maybe I did it 20 years ago or something, and she said she carries it with her all the time. So it's like a fossil. It was so interesting. And she asked me to sign that. So it was really great. It was really nice. I saw two more hands. Yes. Mm-hmm. Can you project?
I'm sorry. Can you talk about your fingertips?
The fingertips? Oh.
As subjectively as you care.
I used to play the piano, and now all I have is the one bell, unfortunately. I really take it to heart. I milk it for all I can, you know, the sound. But anyway, so my fingers are sensitive, I think because of that. And so it's just a natural kind of collected place to put my hands. In the Chan tradition, which I was in for 10 years, a lot of the time I would sit like this, you know, so your hands like this and then like this, thumbs touching. And it's excellent because if you feel sleepy, it's a very, very good thing for sleepiness because your thumbs will, yeah. And your thumbs will start doing it before your whole body starts collapsing, so. It can, and it's quite a beautiful mudra. It's quite a beautiful place to hold your hands. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So I want to do one thing before we leave. I just want to go around the room. Put up with me here. Go around the room, just your first name, and just what is happening right now. One sentence about either how things were over the weekend or present moment. Mental state. You know, so I'm Sally, I'm tired. You know? simple. Just a way to participate and engage. Okay, so we'll start with you. Yeah, you. Okay, All right. So let's just take 2 minutes, a 2 minute sit. And just sensing any degree of warmth and affection and gratitude in your heart, recognizing your efforts over this weekend. Recognizing the effort of sustaining the practice as best you were able to over these few days, and resting easy within yourself, sensing a gratitude in all directions, and allowing the fruit of your practice to bless all beings everywhere. May all beings have ease of mind. May all beings have true comfort of heart. May we and all beings always be embraced by kindness. So, moving out of this environment and expressing your practice in the world. And if anybody wanted me to inscribe a book, I think, Julia, you did, huh? I am available to do that. I don't know where. Okay, good. Okay, good. All right. So, I hope we see one another over and over again. Yeah. We are together in this way, and we all become Dharma brothers and sisters. So, thank you.